The best known and probably greatest popularis leader was Julius Caesar. Although thanks to the way history is manufactured and retailed, very few of us know him in that role. Here are some of the things that Caesar did in his 6 or 7 consulships and after the civil war against Pompey when he served as imperator, which has been misleadingly translated as dictator and more accurately should be called commander-in-chief or supreme commander. Once in power, Caesar founded new settlements for 80,000 proletarians. He distributed some of the choice lands to 20,000 poor families who had 3 or more children. Caesar sent many unemployed proletarians to repair ancient cities in the colonies or slated them for employment on public works in Rome. He ordered every large landholder to have at least 1/3 of his workforce as free labor instead of slave labor. This would compel payment of wages, and it would diminish the landowner's obscenely high profits, and it would reduce unemployment and crime. As relief to poor tenants, Caesar canceled a whole year of rent obligations for low to moderate dwellings. We have some rent control board people here. I know they're feeling warm right now. He increased duties on luxury imports to encourage Italian domestic industry and also to make the rich pay something to the state for their lavish lifestyle. He capped tax rates in the provinces in order to rein in the rapacious tax collectors and give the people in the provinces some relief. He ejected from the Senate a number of those who were associated with provincial plunder and corruption. He allowed repayments of debts at lower pre-war prices. He ordered that the interest people had paid be applied to reducing the principal they owed. Oh, if we could only get some banks to go along with that. He canceled all debt interest that was due since the beginning of the Civil War. This last measure alone, Suetonius reckons, reduced the debt right there with one swipe of the pen, reduced the debt by 1/4, which was a substantial loss to rich creditors. You know, there are 2 theories as to why people fall into debt. One of them says that many people are deprived of adequate income and are subjected to heartless taxes. Being unable to make enough money or keep enough of what they earn, they're forced to borrow on their future labor in the hope that things will get better. As their debt obligation accumulates and more of their income goes into interest payments, they have even less for their own needs and they have to be forced to borrow still more. And caught in this deepening cycle of debt, they're forced to sell their small holdings, their land eventually, and sometimes even themselves or their children into servitude. By the way, Caesar abolished that. Humans could not be reduced to property and could not be sold into servitude because of debt. He laid the groundwork for modern bankruptcy laws. The debt cycle continues to this day, as you know. Whole nations are caught in the debt trap, selling off the land and labor of future generations to international investors at most unfavorable terms. The second theory of debt says that people incur debts because they're irresponsible spendthrifts who try to live off thrifty creditors. In this scenario, In this scenario, the roles of victim and victimizer are reversed. The creditor is seen as the victim, and the debtor is seen as the victimizer. And this model, though, I think does explain the behavior of some people. The only thing wrong is that it's applied to the wrong social group, to the poor. In fact, there are some profligate few, la jeunesse dorée, the gilded youth, who come from socially esteemed backgrounds, who live in a grand style, and they have, through history, cultivated the magic art of borrowing forever while paying back never. Such limitless credit, such big credit, though, is more likely to be extended not to the poor farmer or laborer, but to those of gilded heritage. Caesar's efforts at easing the debt burden were designed to help not the profligate few, but the laboring masses. For Cicero, such reforms really were tantamount to subversion and revolution. And he was voicing the fears of many of his class when he said, quote, "I foresee a bloodbath, an onslaught on private property, the return of democratic exiles, and the cancellation of debts." Cicero believed that Caesar would show no mercy in, quote, killing off the nobility and plundering the well-to-do. In fact, Caesar showed remarkable clemency toward his enemies. He let a lot of them keep their estates. He forgave their armed opposition to him and all that. And by the way, sparing the lives, in some instances, of people who later plotted and participated in the plot against his life. A number of historians argue that Caesar's intent was to attain autocratic power. And we even have the term Caesarism, which was very much in vogue in the 19th century, to mean dictatorial power. Actually, I believe that the crucial consideration is toward what end did Caesar use state power? Cui bono, who benefited? Caesar himself declared, quote, I am sated with glory and power. It is more important for Rome that I live so that we might avoid another civil war. How did Caesar hope to avoid another civil war? By curbing the power of the wealthy oligarchy and leaving something more for the people. By the way, his comment was prophetic. He didn't live, and Rome plunged into a series of protracted civil wars that ended with complete autocracy. Octavius taking power, who later changed his name to Caesar Augustus, the first Roman emperor, about whom I'll say a little more later. In Julius Caesar's own words, I quote him again, I want to protect myself against the slanders of my enemies, to restore to their rightful position the tribunes of the people who have been expelled because of their involvement in my cause, and to reclaim for myself and for the Roman people independence from the domination of a small clique. Caesar's treatment of Athens suggests that had he lived, he might have eventually taken steps to democratize the Roman constitution. After the Civil War, he introduced a democratic constitution for Athens. This is a city that for a century under Roman domination had had this aristocratic rule. The Athenian aristocrats as a comprador class in collaboration with the Roman aristocrats. He brought back democracy to Athens. He enfranchised the population in parts of Gaul he had conquered. That's a democratic move. Early in his career, he helped undo Sulla's reactionary legislation. Sulla, now this is a guy you should know about. Because he's their answer to Pinochet and Suharto and a few other murderers. Sulla was a general who brought an army into Rome, and from 82 to 80 BC, he murdered 1,500 equestrians, 50 senators, and thousands of commoners who had shown sympathy for the democratic cause. He stripped the people's tribunes of their ancient authority to block certain acts by the Senate. Caesar reinstated tribunal authority, another move toward democracy. Caesar began regularly to bypass the Senate and deal only with the assembly. During his first consulship, he regularly disregarded senatorial vetoes. During his dictatorship, he divested the senatorial oligarchy of its executive powers and its control over the treasury and over government appointees. That's moving in a democratic direction. But that's what the elitist historians from Cicero to this day have seen as autocracy, as a violation of the Roman Constitution. It's really a violation of the Senate's prerogatives. Caesar updated and streamlined the voter registration rolls. He granted citizenship to all medical practitioners and professors of liberal arts to encourage them to stay in Rome. He set about to provide Rome with high-quality public libraries. He guaranteed to Jews the right to practice their strange religion, strange to the Romans because it was monotheistic. He was probably one of the very first leaders of antiquity to guarantee religious freedom. He was the first I could find, but you say one of the first because you never know if someone's going to come up in the question period and say, what about Herodotus who pointed out this guy who, you know. So you cover yourself, you say one of the first. Caesar had the proceedings of the Senate and the Assembly published daily. He had them posted all around Rome, making them more accountable to the general public. It was also a way to embarrass the senators when he could. He decisively terminated Cicero's political witch hunts against the Democrats and drove Cicero into exile. He substantially expanded Senate membership to include lesser nobles and nobility from Gaul, and even made senators of a small number of libertini. The libertini were the sons of slaves, the sons of liberated slaves who had risen to distinction on their own merit. All of these appointments, of course, were openly snubbed by the Senate optimates. I mean, they wouldn't even look at these people. The governing posts, many of them, when considerations permitted, were filled by Caesar's slaves, freedmen, or followers of humble birth. Now, some of the Democrats in Rome really sought a total social revolution, a redistribution of wealth among the poor. Some even thought to free the slaves and extend citizenship to foreign residents. Caesar found their support useful, but he was not a social revolutionary. He was a reformer. He abolished all the worker guilds, something I have never forgiven him for, except the ancient ones, and would not go all the way with the Democrats by eliminating all debt payments. And he accrued extraordinary honors and power to himself. He appointed himself not imperator for 6 months, but for life. Caesar was assassinated as he presided over the Senate on March 15, 44 BC, the Ides of March, by a dozen or so senators, led by Cassius and Brutus. There are very vivid accounts in Appian, in Plutarch, and Suetonius. Caesar was very aware that there were these constant plots against his life. He would never move against the plotters. He would just announce his awareness of it, and they would all shrink back. And the story goes is he dismissed his contingent of Spanish guard. He didn't bring them into the Senate with him. The Spanish guard was made up of crack warriors, and they could have taken out the whole Senate, let alone a dozen assassins. But he went in on his own alone. I think it was because he did not want to show that he had any fear of any plot. And I think he'd never imagined they would try to kill him right in the Senate house itself. And supposedly someone came up and handed him a note, which he put in with the sheafs of paper he had, which told him of what was imminent right there, because he had his own undercover people around. And he put the sheet of paper in with his other notes, walked in, and the first senator who approached him to propose a bill took out the dagger, and they all came at him and thrust at him. He gathered up his toga in a protective gesture, staggered, swung back, tried to, and then fell dead at the base of the statue of Pompeii. A story which just sounds too poignant, too significant to strike me as being true, but it's a great story anyway. The historians who are willing to consider any interest except class interest explain away the assassination in terms that are really rather favorable to the assassins. So we're told that the conspirators had a strong distaste for one-man dictatorship. They wanted to preserve their beloved republic. They wanted to preserve the laws and traditions. Others supposedly felt a personal jealousy and rivalry because they were so overshadowed by this truly remarkable man. And to be sure, Julius Caesar was a man of outstanding qualities. He was said to have been a commanding and inspiring figure, uncommonly intelligent, handsome, and utterly charming when he cared to be. He never overindulged in alcohol, unlike many members of his class. His enemy, Cato, once remarked that Caesar was the only sober man who ever tried to wreck the Constitution. He wasn't given to luxurious living, like most members of his class, although he was something of a dandy in his personal attire. He was the son of one of Rome's leading aristocratic families. He was a brilliant military leader who inspired his troops. He was highly regarded for the quality and clarity of his writing and was considered one of the great prose stylists of his day. His intellectual interests were remarkably wide-ranging and deep. He was considered one of Rome's greatest public speakers. He could stir his audience with the force and persuasive clarity of his words while avoiding the purple oratory style, which was the style of that day. Caesar also possessed some less than perfect traits. Like other military commanders of his day, he was a conqueror and plunderer of lands. Although, his army had a high percentage of young men from northern Italian towns who had really become fired up by this idea of civic freedom and spreading that idea, almost like the French Revolutionary Army after the French Revolution, spreading that message to other places. So it wasn't an army built purely on pillage and plunder. There were some ideas there. Caesar extorted huge sums from rich monarchs. I actually cannot get too upset about that one. Caesar was notorious for sleeping with a vast number of women, both married and unmarried, both commoners and members of the highest nobility, including four queens. Who's counting? Four queens. The most famous you all know, Cleopatra, who bore him a son. He also, in his youth, did a king or two, for which he was subjected to homophobic baiting by Cicero and others years later. I'm not going to say anything more about Caesar's sex life. I think in recent times we've heard enough about the sex life of one White House occupant to last us to the end of this century, this empire, certainly, in this century. If Caesar's power upset the Senate, and he did accumulate power, it was because of how he used it. He attempted to deal with unemployment. He attempted to deal with poverty, with unfair taxes, with land redistribution, with debt relief, and with aristocratic greed. I mean, when you tamper with the moneyed privileges of the ruling class, that is what's unforgivable. That's what they hated about him. If the aristocrats longed to protect the Constitution, which, by the way, was an unwritten one based on custom and practice, it was not out of some abstract commitment to Republican principles. It was because the Constitution fortified their oligarchy. It was their law, their Constitution, their republic made to accommodate their class interests. Aristocratic freedom is meant to serve no constituency except the aristocrats themselves. Aristocratic freedom, the freedom of class elites, was and still is to this day antithetical to popular democracy, as it continues to demonstrate as much as pursued by corporate elites with their NAFTA and GATT and MAI and their lobbyists and everything else they do here and abroad. The aristocracy of international global finance ever devising means to making themselves unaccountable to democratic power.